Hello, everybody. Welcome to Fated Mates. I'm Jen Reed's Romance.
And I'm Sarah McLean. Hi, everyone.
Well, it's like 6 degrees here. It's really cold. So it was actually a really good day for me to be reading the Deep Kiss of Winter book because I was really feeling it. I was.
You were wishing that you had a ice dildo?
No,
I'm just
going to
jump right in.
As like, and scene. No,
I had a long conversation last night about ice dildos because I don't get it. But we'll get there, I think.
I mean, I will say it's, well, because here's the thing, like the book is so inexplicable because she like loves it, all the cold. And here it is, I'm like living in my own little polar vortex in Chicago in the past 10 days. And the entire time I was just like, no, Danny, no.
All right. So as Jen said, this is Fated Mates episode 8. And we're finally here, you guys. To everyone who has tweeted us and emailed us and commented on the website and Instagrammed us and said, I don't understand why we didn't start with The Warlord Wants Forever. Here we are, you guys. We're going to do it. Jen and I have plans. We talked about it. We didn't leap right in.
It was not willy-nilly. We had a plan.
It was not willy-nilly. But here we are. We're doing The Warlord Wants Forever, which is what Goodreads would, I think, call 0.5 in the series, the introductory novella of the series, and Untouchable, which is the novella in the Deep Kiss of Winter duology with Cressley and Gina Showalter from Pocketbooks, available wherever books are sold. But it's also, we're doing a couple of really interesting things here. We're wrapping up the Roth brothers. What began with Nikolai in
Warlord Wants Forever.
Sebastian, we're going to see if I can do this, in No Rest for the Wicked. Conrad in,
Dark Desires
After Dusk?
Night's Edge?
Dark Needs at Night's Edge? One of the dark ones.
Right.
We are never going to be able to do it. Ever.
No, ever.
Anyway, Conrad, my favorite, ironically, of the Roths.
Me too, and I was actually really happy to see him come back in this.
Exactly. And Murdoch in Untouchable. Four brothers, all war heroes from the 18th century who were nearly killed in battle and brought back as vampires to just be dreamy men.
You know what's funny is we had talked about, like, you know, horns and claws and teeth or whatever. And I was like, vampires. But every time I look at the ranking spreadsheet, like, they really rank up there. I'm like, oh, no, I love them.
Yeah, I think I love them, too. We've talked before about how I love a blooding.
Yeah.
And because I love it when they have their moment of, like, their heart starts to beat and they literally think they're under attack.
Is this how love feels? Yes.
It's such, like, an overt metaphor, and I love it. And I love everything about them. I love how cold they are. I love how sort of driven they are in a way that a lot of the other Laura creatures are not. We see Rydstrom and Cade sort of as brothers, but these four are really the only, like, friends we see. Like, they're brothers in arms as well as brothers by blood.
I think that's true. I also think that the ties that bind them together are, like, interwoven at every single level. So it's like ties of family, ties of loyalty, ties of, you know, like, time, grief and regret, the fact that they lost their sisters.
Yeah, they have such a deeply shared past in a way that, like, even when you have brothers, when you have sort of a brotherhood of men, when you think about, like, the Black Dagger Brotherhood or, like, the brother-sinster of Stephanie Lawrence, or I wrote my Rules of Scoundrel series is all connected by men. They might have a shared past, but they don't have the kind of depth of shared trauma
that
these four have.
So you and I both are raising only children, but I have two brothers. And I remember at one point, I think it was my older brother who said, like, no one is ever going to know what it was like to grow up in our family but the three of us. And then imagine that that's the case over 300 years, you know, like, right? So I think that that's part of the reason, right? I mean, the Valkyries are sisters, but not, like, right, not in the same way. So I think that there's something really powerful about that bond. And I think the fact that they go to such great lengths to save Conrad, mm-hmm. something we see from his point of view in that book, but something we really see from their point of view in this book, really deepens, like, that whole story also in a way I found really pleasing, which is what is supposed to happen with, right, when those family ties are that strong. So I thought it was really cool the way this book also, these books, I guess, these novellas, like, sort of build on the family mythology in that way.
So let's talk about this, because I think, so the two novellas that we're reading are written 5 years apart.
But happening simultaneously.
But happening simultaneously alongside Conrad's book and Sebastian's book. And also Bo and Mariquetta. Like, so ultimately, and Jen and I have already talked about this, and we're going to talk about it with you guys too. This is really the culmination. Untouchable is the end of an arc, like the sort of first movement of Immortals After Dark.
Yes. There you go.
I don't even know how to begin talking about this, because originally I thought, well, it'll just be 30 minutes on the first one and 30 minutes on the second one, but then...
I don't think that's going to happen. No. I think it's just going to be this quite crazy mishmash, and I hope you read them both, everybody. Let's do a really quick little plot overview, which is basically that in Warlord Wants Forever, Nikolai is blooded by Mist the Coveted, and then she has... makes a little bit of a sport of blooding vampires. We're going to talk more about that later. And she bloods him, and then, knowing full well that he'll never be able to release, like, have sexual release without her, basically leaves him in that state for 5 years.
Yeah, it's not cool. Not cool, Mist.
No, it's not even, like, blue balls. I'm not even sure what that is anymore, right? And so he is determined to essentially, like, hunt her down. And he does hunt her down. And the same night he is out in New Orleans hunting for her is the same night that Nikolai, who's there to help him, is blooded by Daniela, another... Murdoch is blooded by Daniela, another Valkyrie, only she's this ice maiden.
Well, she's part ice fae.
Yes, right.
Her mother was an ice fae, one of her mothers.
From Isengard.
First time, by the way, we see a fae anything.
And then their stories sort of, like, leapfrog back and forth. So, you know, like, we kind of understand that things are happening with Murdoch while they're kind of on hold a little bit with Murdoch and Daniela.
Interestingly, one of the things that I wasn't expecting, and I didn't process, I guess, when we read No Rest for the Wicked, is that they didn't know Sebastian was alive.
Yeah, I remember that. But again, we see it only from Sebastian's point of view, that he kind of knows they're looking for him, but is like, I don't want to deal with them. They blooded me and I hate them. Or mm-hmm. No, they blooded me. They brought me back as a vampire. But yeah, I mean, all those details, just, you know, this many books later, you're like, oh, yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
And I think the story of Mist and Nikolai, I feel like, wraps up in a much tighter fashion, right? Like, they sort of, there's the chain. I think we'll talk about that later, too.
We're definitely going to have some chain conversations.
Right? He essentially says, you're going to stay with me for a couple weeks and we're going to figure this out. We'll just put a pin on that there. But the story of Daniela and Murdoch takes months and months to unfold. He ends up taking her to his, Siberian hunting lodge.
How lucky is that he has a Siberian hunting lodge?
Because it's the only place in her life she's ever been that is, like, sort of the right temperature for her.
Right.
And while they're trying to work things out between them, they sort of mention the other books going by, right? Like, oh, Sebastian mm-hmm. was in the Telsimtai and we watched it, and right, kind of from the computer. And then it's only as Conrad's book is wrapping up that Murdoch's story is kind of wrapping up at the same time.
Well, the interesting thing about that is that during both No Rest for the Wicked and Dark Needs at Night's Edge. Is it Dark Needs at Night's Edge? I can't.
Okay, I'm going to look it up.
I sound like an idiot. It's Dark Needs.
It is Dark Needs at Night's Edge.
Okay. So in both Nikolai's book, no, I'm sorry, not Nikolai. In both Sebastian's book and Conrad's book, Murdoch is super cagey about, and he keeps sort of saying like, oh, I have somewhere to be or I have somewhere to go. And I can't tell you about it. And then Conrad notices that he's been blooded during that book. And then the end, the sort of Conrad-Naomi moment, which then repeats itself in Untouchable from another perspective, from a different POV, is the moment where we realize, like, oh, he's been blooded. Oh, there is a bride and he's leaving for this bride. But who could she possibly be? Right?
Right.
And then Cressley, as we have discovered over the course of this series, as Cressley is wont to do, she just drops Murdoch and like moves on. She goes on to the demon duology. And like, I'm sure readers at the time were like, what is happening? Where's my vampire story? Yeah. Right. And here it is in Untouchable. And just a sort of quick plot wrap up of Untouchable. Murdoch has been blooded by Daniela. The entire conflict of this novella, and it's a solid conflict, is she can't
it's
be...
also 300 pages.
It's a long novella. It's a long like, novella. What? It's not really a novella. It's a novel. We call it a novel.
300 pages. That's a novel.
Yeah, geez, it is. What on earth? Presley.
I think we call it a novella because it gets packaged in with this other thing and we just assume, right?
I know, Jesus Christ.
But then I was like, it's 300 pages.
No, and Gina's story is 220 pages. Like, neither of these are not, you're right, they're not novellas. I don't know, what are we doing? Anyway, we're going to talk about them together anyway.
I think they belong together, though. I feel like we've made a good choice.
Well, but what's interesting about it is that the conflict feels novella-esque. Right?
Yeah.
So, okay. The conflict of Deep Kiss of Winter is... The conflict of Deep Kiss of Winter is... Daniela is an ice fae, and she literally cannot be touched by anybody who is not also of this world, this ice world. She is too cold, and if you touch her, you will burn her. And if she touches you, bad things happen to you, too. I mean, like, she can ice you. She can freeze you. Which is a problem when her fated mate is... not an ice person.
But what's interesting is, like, vampires are known to be cold. And yet he is nowhere near cold enough for her, right?
No way.
No way. I think that's also, it's all about how things that seem so, I think it's just like a cool way of pointing out that, like, I mean, especially going into this next big arc, nothing's really as black and white as it seems. Oh, vampires are so cold. Lol.
Also, I think what's interesting about this, and it's the only time we see it, I think. Correct me if I'm wrong.
An ice dildo? Yes, this is the only time.
It's not that. That's what I'm talking about. We'll get to the ice dildo, too. But this is the only one of the books where it is not enemies to lovers in any way. They like each other. She really, really, really wants him. She wants to be with him. She wants to be near him. She likes him. She thinks he's handsome. She wants him to be able to touch her. Like, she sort of aches for him. Like, there's a moment right at the very start after they've met where she says, like, I wish I could kiss. Like, right away, she's like, I wish I could kiss you. Like, if I could kiss you, we would be in bed right now. Like, if I could touch you.
She was really lonely.
Yeah, so heartbreaking and lovely. Like, there's something very sweet about this novella. And it's, again, it's not a novella, but there are so many things about it that feel novella-esque to me. And this is probably a good time to say we've done an interstitial episode on novellas where we talk about, like, what works in novellas and why novellas do work so well for certain kinds of stories. And I've said in the past, we saw DeShazer in Untouchable again. And I've said in the past that I want DeShazer because I think he's such like a good guy who deserves right. love. But like he doesn't need 450 pages of like lost limb count. And here we get like two really decent people who just are
can't figure it out.
Who
right?
can't literally cannot be together until they figure it out. So let's start with Warlord. Because I feel like I have a lot to say about Untouchable, but it's not near as, like, much.
I
have to say about Warlord. So why don't you tell everybody about Warlord?
One of the things that's really interesting about Warlord is I got tasked with, like, the kind of thing I'm like, oh, yeah, that's perfect for me. I have both versions in E, and I went through and sort of compared them. Because we should just mention that there are... She did we were kind of like, oh, yeah, she rewrote it. And I would go ahead and say now, like, she didn't really rewrite it. She revised it. Now, if you're a writer, it's probably really fascinating to look at her revisions just at, like, the sentence and paragraph and chapter level. She was just breaking things up in a different way, and that you can tell how the pacing is different when she starts to really, like, tighten up sentences and things. A really interesting change is that in the original version, I'm going to call them the A version and the B version. Like A is the first one, B is the second one. In the A version, she calls him Roth all the time. And in the B version, he's almost always Nikolai, which I just thought was interesting, right? And maybe that's because at this point, there's all these other Roth brothers.
Yeah, structurally, it's probably easier.
But also just, it humanizes him.
It's kinder. Mist is not kind.
No, not at all. And by making him Nikolai rather than Roth, I think it reminds us that he's this man too, right? And then there's some really interesting changes, but they're small.
Mm-hmm.
Like where kind of two or three scenes in particular where like the language is changed in such a way that I think it changes the meaning of their interactions.
And that is because of consent.
So let's talk about the chain.
Yeah, you introduced the chain.
So Mist the Coveted has a chain around her waist that is unbreakable. And she has spent a lot of time trying to figure out how to get it off. It's a punishment. I can't remember the exact details. It's not really super important, I don't think. But she's had it with her forever. She's tried to slice it off, burn it off. Like
She's been thrown by it. Like enemies have grabbed her by it and thrown her.
Dangled her over pits.
There's like, this thing is unbreakable.
And what happens is once Nikolai finds her after this 5 years and is basically like, you cannot leave me like this anymore. And you're my bride and you're going to be my wife. And she's like, I'm a pagan. She basically turns to run from him and he grabs at her. And without even trying, the chain breaks.
Comes off in his hand.
And he says to her, like, stop, because he doesn't want her to leave. And she comes to this immediate halt. And he realizes pretty quickly that what the chain does is allow him to control her.
It's a lot.
Yeah.
Because I'm just going to do it. Because, like, the second thing he says to her is come.
And for a minute, you think he means, like, come here.
No, he does not mean come to me. He means come.
Come for me.
Yes.
Yeah.
And it's a lot. And I should say, we are being slightly disingenuous by saying like, oh, we waited until 8 episodes in to do the two novellas together. We did, in fact, wait. We were going to do both the novellas together, but we also knew that there would be a lot of new readers to the series. And we didn't want you to start with Warlord. And part of the reason why is because he grabs that chain and then he says, come. And she just does. And I will also say, this is one of those your faves are problematic moments because I was into it.
I was and I wasn't. I don't know. It made me think about like, if this means something, right? If it's not, if it's a problem... Is it a problem because we want men to be in charge of our orgasms? Is it problem? I mean, like, right, like, I sort of spent some time thinking about, like, why I didn't like it or why I did like it.
Well, it's interesting, though, because it's also a Cressley kind of hallmark, right? There are fingerprints of Cressley all over, obviously. When you've written as many books as she's written and you have such a strong, what we call authorial voice, you know, certain things start to become fingerprints in the text. Cressley loves a hero who says, you don't come until I tell you. I mean, a lot of us do, right? Like, this is not a Cressley. Cressley did not invent this in romance novels. She's not the only one who writes it. But when she does write it, she digs deep. And this, like, these heroes. Edging is a thing in her books.
Yeah.
Holding, like, insisting that heroines hold off on coming is a thing in her books. And then punishment if they can't is a thing in her books. Like, and it's all, of course, like sexual play. By the time we get into the Game Maker series, which I'm going to talk about at the end of this because I think it actually does relate. By the time we get to the Game Maker series, like, of course, like, all the heroines have safe words. Like, it's a completely different thing. But, like, I struggle with Warlord because I get, like, intellectually, like, smart, thoughtful, feminist, like, intellectual Sarah is very keenly aware of the fact that this chain is deeply problematic, right? But, like, id Sarah? Sarah, who's just, like, reading for fantasy and fun, is like, I'm down. And here's why. Because that chain, Cressley establishes from the moment that book begins, that chain doesn't come off. Yeah. So once it does, like, nobody can get this chain off. So once it does, as a reader, you're like, fate of mate. He's supposed to have that. Like, everything that comes after this is essentially, like, it's fated.
I think it's helping us understand that this is real in a way that her blooding him is not.
Yes.
Because in this book, she has blooded previous vampires, like, for fun and entertainment.
Is it explained how she does it?
She just looks at them all sultry-eyed, and then they fall for it. Like, right? Yeah.
It's a bit, like, also the other reason why we held off on this is because, like, I do think that...
That ends. Like, that was just a mistake in the world building, right?
Yeah, it's probably that Cressley wrote A Hunger Like No Other, sold A Hunger... I mean, this is sort of, like, me as an author sort of, like, trying... I'm speculating on the business of it, but I assume she sold A Hunger Like No Other, and then they said, well, what if we wrote, like, a... introductory, you know, whatever, novella to launch the series. And she wrote this, and there are some world building missteps in this book because she didn't know.
Sure. But I think that that's what this then answers, right? Like, so Mist is, like, for fun and entertainment, and, you know, like, there's no Netflix, so she's blooding people.
Which is super mean. Like, essentially, you're sexually torturing a man for as long as they live after that.
Well, and then she kills them. Although we get a lot of her, anger at men later, which we'll talk about. But so I think when the chain breaks, it's the signal to the reader and to Mist and to Nikolai that this is a different kind of blooding.
Shit. Yeah.
Right? And so in that way, I think it's kind of foundational to the plot. I don't think the plot would work the same way without the chain breaking.
Because there would always be this sort of, well, how do we know that we really are fated?
Right. Whereas then when she stops multiple Valkyries from blooding multiple vampires, it just is, right? But in this book, you needed another step.
And once it does sort of code into the trope of fated mates.
Oh, yeah.
Really well, because readers, first of all, I mean, any romance reader knows what fated mates really means. And so it does allow readers to forgive a lot of the controlling pieces of this chain.
Right.
Look, the reality is if you have ever, as a romance reader, like if you are super into the kinky, like the segment of romance kink that involves, like, control, BDSM, dubcon, any of that, this novella is going to work for you. And it probably won't get you as far as you'd like it. Like, but because it sort of, like, it walks up to the line, but it doesn't step over it at all. There's no, like, no. It's not taboo.
No, I don't think so.
I wish Sierra Simone was with us for this one, because I feel like she'd be like, no, this is a zero on the Simone scale.
I mean, and it's interesting because I even think some of the things that seem maybe problematic in the A version get dialed back and smoothed over for the B version.
Well, can we talk about versioning? Because Cressley's, this is not the first time a romance novel has been dialed back and smoothed over. The most famous iteration of this is Whitney, My Love, which is a seminal text for the genre and also a seminal text for most readers who came to the genre in the 90s. Judith McNaught wrote a book called Whitney, My Love. A lot of people believe it's one of the best written historical romances ever. Many of us cut our teeth on the genre with McNaught, myself included. Whitney is not my favorite McNaught novel, but it is certainly up there. And in the first version of that book, the hero believes that the heroine has cheated on him. She has not, but he believes that she has. And to punish her, he horsewhips her. He literally lifts his whip and brings
it. It's not sexy whipping.
No, like he punishes her. He beats
her. Although no whipping is sexy whipping to Jen Reed's romance. Fine.
He beats her with a horsewhip. In the late 90s, early 2000s, Judith McNaught, it was an anniversary edition, I think. She took it back. She rewrote it. She took out the horse whipping. And now in the version that you get online or you get, you know, in the bookstore, Clayton lifts the horse whip and then he can't do it. He's too far gone for her. He can't bear to think to hurt her. And obviously, do I prefer people reading a version where the hero does not beat the heroine? Yes.
Right.
But as a writer and as like sort of, and I, you know, as like a scholar of the genre, part of me is like, wait a second, what are we doing when we're rewriting these? Like, what are we doing to romance? What are we doing to the genre? What are we doing to the history of it? What are we doing to the study of it, the scholarship of it?
Here's the thing, right? The things that we fix now get fixed in E within hours.
Yep.
And we talk about Lisa Claypass a lot, so I'm going to talk about Hello Stranger, right? Mm-hmm. Which is a text where there was Orientalism. And I think she made the right call, right? I'm going to say this. I have questions like you about, like, is this the memory hole? Like, right? Like, I don't know where this is going to go. But there was a large moment, like, there's Orientalism in the text where the hero essentially, like, tells the heroine he's, like, learned his lovemaking skills from some woman in India. And she doesn't have a name. She doesn't have a face. She doesn't have a backstory. She's just there to teach him how to fuck.
And this is a sort of classic romance, old school romance trope, too, right? Like, this speaks to Lisa having been writing the tropiest historicals ever for as long as she's been writing, right? Like, we've seen, there's nothing new about this. This has been in romances forever.
Yeah, well, what's new about it, though, is the people who are hurt by this have a voice.
Sure.
Right? And they can say, this is not okay, and it hurts to read it, and I don't like how I feel when I come across my own culture being othered in a romance novel that I'm not there for. And it essentially got excised from the text.
Yeah, Lisa heard it. She was, I mean, I don't know Lisa, but it seemed she was devastated by what she had done and how she had made people feel. And she and HarperCollins rewrote it. They distributed a new version of the book. And they fix the problem. And I should also say, like, as a writer, if I fuck up, I want to fix it. Like, I want to fix the book. And I want it to be, I never, ever want my books to hurt people. So Sarah McLean wants to fix her books. But Sarah McLean reader is saying, like, I just keep coming back to, like, if romance is there to iterate on the world, right, and to center women in the world and the issues that women face in the world, when we take out the horse whipping, are we silencing a sort of past? Are we burying a past? And we are, like, we are burying a past. But, like, does it matter? I don't know. I'm really of two minds on this. I will never feel, like, 100% great about either version of this.
I guess what I would say is I feel fucking great about fixing a text where the people hurt are the readers, as opposed to fixing something in the text that's just changed over time.
I get that. But at the same time, like, thinking about those old romances, right? Like, all the the chic romances and the Native American romances and like Savage Thunder. Like those books, do we take them out of circulation or do we start talking about, do we rewrite them? Do we take them out of circulation? Like do we say, or do we say like those chic books were and are often problematic? Savage Thunder is problematic.
Well, when I reread Prisoner of My Desire, well, I didn't reread it. When I read it, I didn't read it the same way I read a romance now. I think, sure. I was like, I read it like an anthropologist.
It's a historical text.
Yes, I'm reading it as a historical text. So in that case, I don't want it changed because I'm not reading it the same way. And I guess I'm wondering, but what I'm wondering is that window basically so fucking short now that it took 30 years for us to be like, okay, and now it's like 30 minutes, you know, and I just don't know, right? Like if Prisoner of My Desire would just never come out now.
No, nobody would, I mean, maybe it would. It would be self-published probably.
Yeah, there you go. So, I mean, I don't know. I mean, I think this is like a real question and it's.
This is an academic question. What happened with Lisa's book is absolutely how it should happen. And if like my book comes out and it's problematic and I fuck up, like I want you to tell me so that I can fix it. But like if you're talking also, I think there's something to be said for the fact that something like Whitney, My Love, it is a text that launched a genre, right? Like,
yeah,
one might argue like without Whitney, would Sarah McLean exist? Like you really can, if it's the sort of butterfly wing, the butterfly effect, like you really can draw a line from modern historicals back to McNaught. So like if we change Whitney.
Yeah, I don't know.
It's a mind fuck is what it is. Because you think to yourself, like, there's nothing about that scene that is good. Like Clayton is a bastard of a hero. Like he's right. Not, but like a lot of people name their kids Clayton. He right. Worked for a lot of readers.
Maybe there's just no answer. I think we just like noodle it over and like we talk about it. But I will say one of the really interesting things that gets excised in the B version, and I talked about this on a previous podcast, is that Mist calls the nymphs hookers in the A version. She's like, those hookers, and it gets cut. The sort of like, I'm going to call these other women names. And I thought that was really interesting.
That should happen.
Yeah.
But it also, like, again, taking the step back, like, that's the difference between 2006 and 2018, yeah. Right?
Right.
And, like, there's something really remarkable in the shift. And, like, and we wouldn't know it, right? If there were no B version, we would never be able to sort of academically say, like, look at how romance changed the way, like, romance started to think differently about sex workers.
Yeah. I think a lot about, I bet romance, I bet anybody, if someone's like, here, have a bunch of money to do a PhD with Eric Sellinger at DePaul on romance, I would probably do it on gender, how gender is changing and how romance reflects that so fast.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, 5 years ago, the way we would have talked about like a transgender person or, right, like it has changed with such speed.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe it hasn't changed enough, right, in some ways. But I think that if you looked at the way romance talks about and reflects, like, our world, it probably is, outside of television, one of the best. Well, and maybe even more
well,
so
it is.
Because it's so focused on it's so focused on relationships.
Sure. And it's domestic, right? It's a domestic genre. And I use that word, you know, intentionally. It's because it's women, it owns a part of culture that traditionally isn't documented.
Right.
So
right.
It is a fascinating, these choices to rewrite. And look, I also think there's a difference between I think Cressley's choice to rewrite Warlord also speaks to like Cressley trying to the fact that as we write, we have to do better every book, right? Like we have to represent ourselves. If we're changing, if the world is changing around us, and if our views of the world are changing along with that world, like the books change too. And we're now in a position of having a luxury to change, to sort of say like, well, if I could go back and rewrite that scene, what would I do? And Cressley's lucky, right, in that she's Cressley Cole and can call her publisher and say, I want to rewrite it.
I think the other word I would like just to point out that gets excised from the text is when right after he breaks the chain in the A version, she says, you keep calling me wife, but I think the word you're looking for is slave. And slave gets cut out of the B version. And I think that was a good call. Yeah. Yeah. Right? Like, I think it's going to be problematic for this world that is mostly full of white people.
Yeah.
Right? Even if they're immortals, to like be thrown around the word slave with any kind of,
yeah,
you know, magic fair, like, haha. Like, it wasn't funny, but it was like, it's jarring, right, to see sure. it. And
so, I mean, she does the right thing. These choices are important. And that's why when we recommended that you read the one, that you hold off on Warlord, and two, that when you got to this episode of the podcast, you read the new version. It's because we want to be thoughtful about presenting the books the way that Cressley wants them presented.
I think ultimately, though, one of the other, I mean, I think the most interesting scene in Warlord is when they first have sex in some ways, because even though Nikolai has the chain, he tells her, like, I'm not going to have sex with you until you tell me you want it. Right. So there's like the consent issue isn't, it's, you know, he doesn't rape her. He does like lose his mind. She tries to run away from him and they have sex basically out in this field. And it gets softened a little bit in the B version, not that much. And the thing that is really clear is his like aggressive, like domineering taking of her. Is she super into it?
Yep.
And so even if like you as a reader are not into it, it's not, it didn't feel like rape to me. And it did to some of my friends when we talked about it, because it is like, right, he is taking her, but she is so fucking turned on right. by it.
Well, this is, we've talked about this 1,000 times. This is why point of view, like authorial yeah. choice when it comes to character point of view in sex scenes is very important and should be done. For those of you who are writers, like, this is about, in this has to be about intent on your part as a writer, like, who gets mm-hmm. to be the one who is consenting, and the yeah. POV of a sex scene should be the character who needs to consent the most for whatever reason, yeah. right? And I think Cressley has always done that very well. I will say, this is where I want to talk about the Game Maker series. So,
okay,
we wrap. You know, like we said, this is the end of that sort of the Roth brother movement.
Right.
Sort of first movement of IAD. We're putting vampires away until Lothair comes into play again. There yeah. are no vampires between now and then. And then after Lothair, there are no vampires until
The Dachshunds, whatever. Oh, right. Trehan.
Are they the Dachshunds? I always pronounce it the Dacians, but whatever.
I don't know.
They're like the Lothair people, but that's a separate thing. But like the main IAD arc, we're actually not going to yeah. read all the Dacian books. So as part of the podcast, so
I think we're gonna partner them the same way we did these yeah. two worlds.
So
to be discussed at a later
anyway.
Date.
So this is really the end of vampires, but it is not the end of the vampire archetype for Cressley, because she is about to launch in, 2 or 3 years from this moment in the books, she is going to launch the Game Maker series, which is a contemporary erotic trilogy about brothers who are in an organized crime family. And they are all Russian. And they are all like 6'7" and broad, and they look like Murdoch, and they dress like Murdoch, and they're perfect in every yeah. way, and they are amazing. And we are gonna do the 3 Game Makers books as part of the podcast. But it's almost like what Cressley did was pack up the vampires, set them aside, see right. Lothair through, because Lothair is going to be so critical to the second movement of IAD, which I refer to lovingly as Torture Island, and then. And then once she packs Lothair up, launch these sort of modern day vampires. And I use vampire right. with like a lowercase v. Like, it's really just the vampire archetype again.
Can I tell you something hilarious?
Please.
When I had my first Cressley Cole were the Game Maker series. And I remember reading some sort of interview with her where I like just wasn't, sometimes I wasn't a very close reader. I don't know, where she sort of was like, oh yeah, the big difference is like these just are like super sexy. And so when I read, I was like, yeah, no kidding, lady, Jesus. When I read A Hunger Like No Other, I thought that meant they were like low heat. And then I was like, oh, like Cressley Cole low heat is still like fucking Ghost Pepper Town. I just had no idea. It was so funny.
They're just not, A Hunger Like No Other just isn't the full Cressley, as Sierra Simone right. would refer to it. The full Cressley.
Oh, man.
So,
that's amazing.
So anyway, I think there's,
do you think there's more we need to talk about Warlord?
I don't think
we
so.
Have to,
I think we're good.
Okay. I feel.
I want to talk about, so I have opinions about Untouchable as a writer, like as okay. from a business perspective, and I don't know how interesting those will be. So why don't you start with Untouchable and then we'll get there, or I'm happy to talk about the business piece.
I think we all are very interested in the business piece. I think I covered the kind of plot enough, right? Yeah. Like, so it's Murdoch and Daniela. He's kind of keeping it on the down low. She's this ice maiden. They can't, you know, she can't be touched. He really is dying to touch her. I think the interesting thing about their conflict is, like, you're like, they're both nice people. They're both really afraid to commit, yeah. right? She's really lonely and she doesn't trust him. He's been a player, right?
I don't know that she's afraid to commit. I think she's just she's protecting herself, like,
right, because he's this player and she thinks,
and he can't, yeah. literally he cannot touch her without hurting her.
I'm not sure that
he can't touch me without hurting me thing would have worked. Here's an academic sort of intellectual exercise. If this series weren't so sexy, sex wasn't so much a part of these characters and all of their fates, could this plot have worked? Because I feel like I 100% believed that these two people could not possibly be together and work out if they couldn't touch.
So here's why I think it's actually symbolically important, and I think it's more so for Murdoch than Daniela. There's this really interesting scene where, he had been like the playboy of the Roth brothers. And there's this really interesting part where he says to her, like, I was just as committed to our like warlord efforts, right? Like, I fought just as hard. I was just as committed to our family. And yet because we did different things on our downtime, I got tagged with being the like playboy, and he never liked that. So I think the reason that this kind of works as for his character arc is that he really needs to see that he actually is more than just his sexual proclivities. And being able to just be with her without that kind of forces him to grapple, I think, with letting go of that story he had about himself.
Okay. No,
here's my problem, though. Yeah. I don't know that it needed that. It just doesn't.
It's an interesting thing. So, all right.
I liked Murdoch, but this wasn't my favorite.
No, it wasn't it's not my favorite either. I mean, I think neither of them are my favorites. You know, largely because Warlord just, it couldn't pop. I don't think Warlord is anybody's favorite because it just comes too right. early in the series and like things just get more right. complicated and more interesting. I right. really liked Untouchable, but I liked it as an IAD reader. Like, I liked yeah. it for all
there
of the
go.
And this is where the business of it comes in. So it's basically like 300 pages of like, it's a dream novella for a romance fan, because it's 300 pages of seeing all the characters that you've seen already, that you know, and
yes.
who you love. It shows
Conrad
you
Roth.
All the stories. Yeah, Conrad. It shows you all the stories, all the like key moments of the Roth brotherhood, but from a new perspective, mm-hmm. which is really delicious. You get to hang out with Loa in her New Orleans shop. You see DeShazer hang out. You realize DeShazer is a smoke demon, which we didn't know before. And so he has a swimbo who calls him to her. You know, you start to see, like, there are these really fascinating glimpses of what are called low creatures, the kind of who I assume will ultimately be part of the Pravis army.
Yeah.
Kobolds and things like that. Like, the world building in this novella alone is really about world building the series. It starts, like, everything turns up. Valhall, the Wraiths.
The Valkyrie sisters that got brought back playing video games in Valhall. Yeah. Thrain's key and why they didn't use it and what their plan is for using it. Like, all that stuff gets just, like, a little, like, revisit. Yeah. It's like, hey, I didn't forget. Hey, I didn't forget. Hey, I didn't forget.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, like, it's 300 pages long, but it's probably 75 pages of let's talk about IAD.
Well, exactly. And I think this is why I think one of the things I was saying before we started recording is one of the reasons this, like, doesn't really work for me is because I feel like it was the first time I figured out how to fix their fucking problem before they did. Mm. Right? I was like, hey, dumbass, if you just fucking drink her blood, you are going to be able to touch her. Get on it. And I felt like, like, why couldn't these two dummies figure it out when I could?
It's really interesting because it's sort of, it happens right at the very start. Nikolai goes to Kristoff and says, like, I'm a blood drinker now because I drink from my wife and or my bride. And Kristoff is like, well, what should we do, men? and like all the men are like, what? That sounds awesome.
Yeah, right.
And so Kristoff is like, well, I guess that's okay then as long as you don't kill her, right?
I know.
And that happens right at the start of the story. And like then it is about 150 pages of Murdoch wanting it and Daniela not wanting it. And it goes on. And you're right. Like, it does become very clear pretty quickly that, like, this is the solution. Like, if he drinks from her, she's going to be able to survive. But I think that there's lots of other stuff going on here that I love. Leaving aside, like, all the little glimpses at the rest of the universe. You know, I did say in our novella episode that part of why Christmas novellas work so well in series is because Christmas is a natural time to revisit all these other characters. And that's, like, sort of what she's done here.
They literally end at Christmas sitting around a fire. Yeah. That's for real. Yeah,
it's like, a Christmas. It's a Christmas novella. And which I had forgotten we would have brought it up on our Christmas episode. But I also think like there are some interesting things that happen that are echoes of what is to come. And I said this before we started recording today, but I really feel like Untouchable is like a Cressley brainstorm activity. Like, she's sitting down and she's sort of like working out all of the different things that are happening in the lore and might be happening in the lore and all the characters who are important and like who will come back and who won't come back and how they all interact. It's the first time we see a completely new world that is disconnected from other characters, right? Like, it's the first time we go off plane besides Rathkalina, which is a different kind of thing because that's like the hero's home base. In this particular case, like being able to stand in like the ice world to meet other people who are in those ice worlds. It's like she's really starting to say like, oh, I can go big. Like I can.
Yeah, this is bigger.
This world is infinite. There are as many worlds as possible can exist in this IAD universe.
Yeah.
This is why I said, like, well, maybe it's a little bit business because it is certainly, like, all the Gina Showalter fans who picked up this series who'd never picked up a Cressley Cole book are now like, oh, this seems like a cool world. I want to try it. But it's also a little bit craft in the sense that I really do think she's testing things out.
And wrapping things up.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah. So there's a lot of ways in which it's like, okay, I have to close the door on the Roth. I'm closing the doors on the Roth brothers, on Thrain's Key. Like, yes, Catherine's sisters are still hanging out in Valhall. Like, all those things get sort of like wrapped up. Yes, they're still here. And then it's like Gareth and Lucia, which is what's next, are really starts the Torture Island. It's going to kind of kickstart the Torture Island like arc. So I do think it's both like laying groundwork, but then just like really tying off like loose ends that still exist. The thing I really wanted to talk about is reading people's memories when you drink their blood.
Mm.
And part of the reason why is because I started to wonder, especially reading two vampire books, like these two vampires, right back to back, if it isn't cheating to have the way these men learn their women's, like, it's this really powerful act of empathy, right? Ideally. Mm-hmm. Like, and you don't get shown everything until they're ready. I don't really, right? But I kind of felt like, isn't it cheating, though? Like, that these men can just, like, figure this all out without having to do the work of sitting down and, like, gaining their trust? It's this really interesting shortcut.
It is. It's a shortcut. It's a trick.
Yeah.
And
that doesn't mean it doesn't work, but I was interested in it.
Some of the most powerful moments, I think, for me when I read romance, and some of the most powerful scenes, I hope, in my books that I've written, are the moments where the hero reveals his past, like his deepest wound. And invariably, certainly in my books, like, that doesn't happen until almost right at the end of the book. Because it's an incredible act of trust. And I think that this is a really interesting way of getting that information on the page without forcing the hero to sort of unpack his own drama. And I think the trust piece here comes from, I mean, it's interesting because the act of trust is the bite, right?
Yeah, I guess. But it's not always. Like, right, in this case, he does it. She doesn't want him to.
No, she doesn't. There's a consent issue here, too.
Right. Well, I guess what I'm saying, too, is it feels like those moments where you, like, bare your soul and tell your worst story to the person you love
should be emotional and personal.
Yes.
But it's interesting because I don't have a – I'm thinking about it. I'm sort of being weird about it because, as you all know, Sweet Ruin is my favorite – possibly book of all time. And and there's dreaming of memories in that book, and it really works for me. And so I wonder if I wonder, right, because in that book it's the reverse. It's the heroine dreaming the hero's memories.
And this is what I actually was thinking, like, up until this point, I think the reason it feels like a shortcut or a cheat is because it allows these men to get information, like, right, information that's really vital to their partner, to their fated mate, without doing the hard work of proving themselves trustworthy.
Right.
So then it's like this responsibility that gets dumped in their laps, and we see that they do the right thing with it. But interesting, like Daniela's mother, her fated mate kills her, right? So it also feels like this could go wrong.
Yeah. I thought that was really interesting, by the way, that Daniela's parents were fated and her father killed her mother.
Yeah, I thought that was interesting too. Now, again, I'm not saying, it's like kind of, I feel bad. I'm like, I'm bringing up this thing and I don't know how I feel about it.
Well.
But I think, right, well, I guess that's why we're doing it.
That's the podcast.
Yeah, right? I think the thing I kept thinking about, though, is maybe the test then is, what do you do with this information once you have it? And it's clear that they don't get all the information all at once. Mm-mm. There is some sort of, like, metering light on this thing, right? Mm-hmm. That only allows them to see the worst parts of it or the key parts of it when they're ready.
It's interesting because what Murdoch sees in Daniela's dream, what Murdoch dreams of Daniela's memories, is her time as a sex slave in a Roman, you know, court of, right, a Roman whatever. It's such a trauma that he witnesses that you almost feel as though it worked for me, because as a reader, I was like, well, this is not a thing you would just sit down and
disclose to
exactly
someone,
right? And it comes only after she said, like, I didn't want you to bite me, and now you're the second man who's ever touched me without my consent,
right.
And he's like, whoa, what? Like, what?
Yeah.
And then he has this vision of the man, the first person who had done that to her in a sort of atrocious way. And then he sort of sees in, like, it is a moment where he's able to reflect on his own actions.
I think the reason it also kind of works is, unlike when we tell our own worst stories to people, it's very hard to capture and name your own worst traumas.
Sure.
And in this moment where you experience it as the person who was experiencing it, right? The burden of having to describe what it was like,
yeah,
has been lifted from these women. And yet the heroes somehow feel that, in this case, what it was like to be victimized, or right, or what it was like to feel unbearable grief in this case, mm-hmm. or what it's like to experience loss from the perspective of the person, as the person who felt those mm-hmm. things. And that kind of like empathy, there's no way to do that just through conversation. So maybe it has to be supercharged because they're immortals. But I don't know. I spent a lot of time thinking about that.
I want to put a pin in this and like come back to it anytime anybody's dreaming memories. I mean, we are going to, this is Lothair's whole thing, right? Like all he wants to do is dream memories. So we're going to see him do it a lot. We're going to see Josie do it. I think that's it.
I mean, so that's it too. It's like the continuum between when it's like, if it's just this one person and you can like mainline their story versus it's thousands of people and it literally drives you insane.
Right. Well, and we've seen all the other Roth brothers dream memories too, and we've seen them dream mm-hmm. like very different experiences, right? Like Nikolai is yep. totally destroyed by all of the memories that he dreams of Miss because he doesn't see the end of them ever. Right. Like he thinks she's been betraying men her whole life, that this is the game she plays, but he doesn't see the truth. Sebastian does the same thing with Caterin, where Caterin's the one who saved the small child, who lost the child, right? Like in the Viking mother and child. They typically, when a Roth brother dreams the memories of his love, he's dreaming them, but in a way that he's not dreaming the truth. He's just dreaming a piece of it. But Murdoch dreams the truth. He dreams the real memory beginning to end.
Yeah, but he also takes it from her in a different way, or it's so much later, he knows her so much better,
or it's a way for him to sort of reflect on his own behavior in a way that the other ones are not. The other way, like,
yeah,
when the other ones are dreaming their mate's memories,
it's confirmation bias.
Yeah, it's like moving the conflict forward. Here it's this memory does sort of instigate the dark moment in the book.
Yeah,
when he starts to realize like what he's done.
It's totally the low moment, because right after this happens, he gets immobilized by the mm-hmm. Jordan guy, whatever his name is.
Yeah, P.S. He's dreamy. Where's my ice hero
yeah.
book, Cressley?
Hello, a word. I was like, weren't we saying that we needed more novellas? I was like, who would they be? This dude and his fire maiden. I want it.
I know. Except it's the same story, and now we know how it's cured.
But I do think that, like, in that case, in that sense, I mean, right. Like, so because the world of this book, it did feel like I kind of could guess what was going to happen or how it was going to turn out. I did, I guess, find myself then reflecting more on some of these, like, the internal tropes of IAD. Mm-hmm. Like, I can dream your memories now, or I can, right? Mm-hmm. Like, because there was more time to just, like, ruminate on them.
Also, we start to see other things. This is the first book where someone vows to the lore, but it doesn't seem to matter. One of the kobolds vows to the lore. But there are a lot of vows that go on in this book. And Murdoch vows not to touch her. So we know at this point the vow to the lore is still not canon. But one of the kobolds does. He vows to the lore. But it's almost like, I swear to God. Like,
yeah,
it's
right.
It's a separate thing. So I'm getting really excited. By the way, this is one I know you and I are super nerdy about, like, different stuff. This is one of those things that, like, when this happens for the first time and it's coded in, I'm going to be like, we're going to talk for 20 minutes about why it's now.
Now the vows to the lore are set in stone. Or just, like, how much, like, you know, you're so used to, like, thinking about these books a certain way that you don't realize you've, like, retconned in Vow to the Lore yeah. until you start rereading and realize, wait, this hasn't
exactly.
happened yet.
Exactly.
Or like her blooding multiple vampires, right? Like then those things really stick out and you think, oh, there's this thing in the world that wasn't working or that was missing.
Well, so I guess my other question, and this is the question for readers or listeners, is were we right to make you wait? You know, do you wish that we'd started with Warlord? Do you feel like we've missed the boat in not starting with Warlord? Like, was there something that you know, worked for you that didn't work for us, or some reason why you would have changed this order up? And I guess the other question that I have now for all of you is, please hit us up on Twitter and Instagram and all the other places where you can find us and let us know, like, what are your thoughts on this first movement? Like, do you agree that it feels like it's just getting bigger and bigger every week, every month, every week, every book? You know, I'm interested in all of your thoughts, because I do think now is the time to sort of pause and reflect on everything, because in 2 weeks, we're going to start moving toward Torture Island. For those of you who are not, who are reading along, Torture Island. It's apt, but it's still romance novels. So. Well, we're tipping into the full Cressley now. Like, I mean, it's going to happen soon.
I don't know that anybody lost any limbs in either of these.
Oh, yeah, I was going to say, I didn't get a limb. I had no addition to the limb count.
Now, there was a big old fight that Murdoch's in where he needs, like, stitches and gets, like, really knocked around.
And she but gets it doesn't stabbed.
Yeah, but it's not, like, typical.
No. She doesn't, there's no even death. Like, I thought at some point, like, well, she's got this skill of, like, freezing people until they, you know, become blocks of ice. Like, that's surely going to happen. And it didn't.
All the deaths are sort of like the Aesir who come to fight, you know, kind of try and kill her. And I mean, but it's in terms of like mortal danger to our actual in both this and Warlord, it's all emotional.
Yeah.
Danger.
I mean, I really think these are Nikolai and Mist are just, they're kind of assholes to each other. But Danny and Murdoch, they're good people who just want to be in love.
I know.
Let them be in love. My favorite moment of this Untouchable, by the way, is when Lois sells Murdoch the gloves. And she's like, here, these are on sale. give these to your Valkyrie and tell her to be careful with you. Right? Like, I love that.
Like, let me help you out with this.
I love Loa.
I love Loa, too.
Also, we learned Loa went to Notre Dame. We learned.
But not, right? Like, yeah. Like, oh, no. But that's like, she tells people she didn't.
She tells even people though she's like from, she's like a Caribbean voodoo priestess. But like, she's actually like from Pennsylvania and and went to Notre Dame. And it's really like, but it's interesting because Loa has always been my, like, I'm so interested in Loa. Because she's so fascinating. But like, I keep thinking like Untouchable is just Cressley like figuring shit out in like a wonderful, I don't mean that in like a, it's messy and she's just scribbling. No. It's a really beautiful exercise in, I feel like if you think about world building at all as a writer or as a reader or as a teacher, like, this is a perfect example of like how to really start thinking about the world that you're in. Like, I wish we could all write this novella for the worlds that we're writing. Like, I want to write the Bare Knuckle Bastards Untouchable, just like to sort of like figure it out.
Well, and that's the thing, it feels like a gift in that way, right? I think there's a couple moments I really liked this, and one is Daniela meets the like handsome ice guy or whatever, and he offers to kiss her, and at this point she's pissed at Murdoch, and so she agrees to it because she's never been kissed before, and Murdoch catches them and he says to her, like, he took what was mine, I was gonna be the first one to kiss you. And I was like, oh, and
that's
it's so
amazing
sweet.
And also I love that scene too, but I love the part that's in her point of view where she thinks to herself, like, this is nice, and if I could do it with Murdoch, I would never stop. Like, and it's so beautiful because also, like, I had this moment where I was like, oh, I bet those readers who, like, hate cheating don't love this. But, like, it's so honest. Like, if you had never kissed anybody and, like, some dude was like, I'm able to do, like, I'm the one who can you would.
Yeah, you'd be like, sure.
Because you'd be like, I want to experience this thing.
Well, and he had kissed a couple people earlier. And so it also, yeah. There's like that parody, yeah. Right? There's like a way in which she, and when he sort of is like, I can't believe you did that. She like throws back at him exactly what he said. There's another really funny part of this, and I'm actually going to record it and like send it to Eric. But I listened to the audio for this too. Mm-hmm. And there's this one really funny part where she is like imitating him. So like Robert Petcoff doing Danny imitating Murdoch's voice is like, and I was like, this man can do anything.
Put it on the list for Petcoff when we interview him. Be like, I know. I would like you to do Nick's pretending to be Lothair, pretending to be. Yeah.
Well, and also like you really get at the end when all the Murdoch brothers are together and talking to each other. I don't even know how he could have done that. It must have been, I mean, he must have been like, okay, now play me Sebastian.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
That's like, funny. There's no other way. It was crazy. But there were some really sweet things in this book.
Also, we see Nick's, that I really love the, like, this is the first round of Nick's where I started to see Nick's being tired. And it was, again, I can't say enough that I feel like Cressley just like knocks this out of the park in terms of really like establishing what's coming, because Nyx is tired in this book and she doesn't, her phone, at one point she's on the phone with Danny and her phone is just constantly like clicking. There's a new call coming in every like 2 seconds and she's just like, everyone wants a piece of me. And during that conversation, Danny says at one point like, well, can I ask you this thing? And it's like something related to Murdoch. And Nyx is like, I don't want to talk about that. Like, I want to just gossip for a second, you know? And like, it's really like, there's a humanity to Nyx in this book that you haven't seen before.
And you know what? Here's like one other little really super interesting thing in the A and the versus the B version. Mm-hmm. In the B in the A version at the end
of Warlord.
She says, "I'm not predeterminationally abled for nothing."
Nyx says this?
Yes, and in the B version she says ever knowing.
Right?
It's so Nyx the ever-knowing is not like a phrase in Warlord in the A version. It's only in the B version, right?
That's what's so cool about doing. I mean, I know we sound super nerdy, you guys, but like it, what's the coolest thing about doing this podcast is the sort of close read of,
oh yeah,
where you do. We have retconned a ton of stuff into this series that I just realized, like, while we were talking that I've been talking about Vows to the Lore forever. If people are reading along with the podcast, they have no idea what that means. I'm not going to tell you.
You're going to have to wait.
I think we need a wrap. I want to just give a shout out to Jen because I don't know if you guys on your podcast apps are scrolling through show notes, but you should because they're bananas.
I'm very proud
of
them.
They're incredibly thorough. They're like the greatest show notes in podcasting right now, I'm pretty sure. They involve copious amounts of research and links, and Jen takes hours every week to do them, and they're magnificent. I also want to give a shout out to Apple because apparently if you just say to Siri, "Hey Siri, subscribe to Fated Mates," Siri will subscribe you to Fated Mates. So for iPhone listeners, if you are not subscribed, you can just ask Siri to subscribe you, and that would be great. We would love that. Also, iPhone listeners, apparently you can just say, "Hey Siri, play Fated Mates," and it'll play you the most recent episode. So
that's pretty cool.
Enjoy that little Easter egg.
Oh, in iTunes, like in the podcast app, you can now see the pictures go by, although you can't see the chapter titles.
Oh.
And that seems kind of new.
Yeah, there are pictures. We have all of these podcasts are also, this is because of Jen, they are all chaptered. So if you want to skip ahead to, you know, the part where we talk about carriage sex with Joanna Shoup, you can. and that section of the podcast, that chapter will have its own art. Jen's fabulous.
is Harry and Meghan, you guys, because I like to imagine that they pulled that carriage up into a more private place and enjoyed themselves.
That's exactly what they did. That would for sure what happened.
They made a baby in that carriage. Awkward. Sorry, Meghan. Oh, next week we have an interstitial about Scotland.
Oh, Scotland. We love Scotland.
Highlander times, as they say on the Heaving Bosoms podcast.
Shout out Heaving Bosoms. We love Scotland and, you know, like are fun from there.
Right. That's why it's going to be a nice lead in to Gareth and Lucia.
Yes. And then on the Gareth and Lucia episode, what is the name of that book, Jen?
Oh, Jesus. Pleasure of a Dark Prince.
Oh, okay. Really? Who's a prince? Is Gareth a prince? I guess he is. He's Gareth McCreeve. He's the prince of the werelords.
The werelords. Oh, my God. Write that book.
Okay.
Yeah, I think I was confused by that, too. Remember? I was like, Demon from the Dark. I got it. Pleasure of Dark Prince. Who's the prince?
It's Gareth. Gareth McCreeve and Lucia. And I will say, in my memories of this series, Gareth and Lucia, this is one of my very favorites of all the books. Yeah, so I am hoping, I have not reread it in a while and I'm excited about it. And Gareth and Lucia begin, this is going to start a whole new arc.
Yep.
And
a movement.
A movement, if you will. And also in that episode, we will finally have our interview with moon scientists.
Oh, that's
it's
right.
It's our moon episode. So get excited, nerds.
Oh, I'm so excited.
All right. As always, you guys, thanks for listening. Please leave us notes, tweet us, Instagram us, leave us a review on whatever podcasting platform you listen to us on. If you love us, share with your friends and family. And thanks for being with us.
See you next week on Fated Mates.
I've been ordered to protect her, Murdoch added. Protect Mist? This is a considerable change from... She imitated his low, accented voice. Mist is Nikolai's enemy. We hate Mist. She's mean. His lips quirked, which seemed to surprise him. Then he resumed his scowl.
And I've noticed even on Siri, although you can't see the chapter tight, or
you just turned Siri on. Ooh. Somebody just... Oh, I did.
Sorry.
Apple.com Sorry, should Siri. Be able to answer that question and more.
Your Siri has a sexy
my
man
Siri
voice.
Is, my Siri is a British man, which will come as no surprise to anyone.
Siri.
Exactly.
Okay. Here's why. Now I can't remember what I was going to say. Meh.